Through Thinking. It is the second Monday of the month. Today we have Understanding Autism. I'm Paul Loudon. I've been doing this radio show for a bit over a year now. I am a 29-year-old on the autism spectrum. We have Kim Isaac, who has been working with people on the autism spectrum for 15 years now. She is a certified RDI consultant. And Dave Isaac, who hosts our great show.
And come
Big
on,
Daddy
you're
Dave.
Big Daddy Dave, you coined the term and or the name. And there is one other thing, Dave Isaac, the great, three initials, NLP. I knew I'd get it in. I got it in early this time, and to the dismay of the panel here.
Okay. I heard you work it into your last show, too.
I did, yeah, you noticed that. Yeah, that was Coach's Corner. That's a good show. Did you hear some of
it? I did hear some of it.
They're
it
very cool people, Joe and Lori Battaglia.
Like
nice people. Good information. So you got a great show today. You two. You guys are just the bomb. What's that mean, by the way? The bomb.
I have no idea.
I've heard of it, and it means something good.
The bomb
though.
Means, like, awesome.
Yeah, that's what I thought. You guys are the bomb, a.k.a. awesome.
That's another one of those things someone like me wouldn't really understand. Well, I think a bomb, bad thing.
You're right.
Literal.
Is it spelled the same way?
Yeah.
Oh,
maybe D-A instead of the, but, you know.
Oh, yeah, the bomb. Yeah.
Well, Dad, anyway, where are you hearing these terms?
I don't know. So people call me the bomb.
Oh.
Exactly.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, that's what I thought, except they go, get this vest off. The bomb. Okay, no one got that but Paul. Okay, life is more than a skill set and learning processes in addition to skills. That's the topic. I like it. This is a continuation from last month. I right about that?
You are right about that. And before we get into that topic, I just have a couple of quick announcements. I wanted to remind everybody about the 13th annual Autism Asperger's Conference. It's on March 30th and 31st at the Madcap Theater in Tempe, Arizona. And Temple Grandin is one of the keynote speakers, as well as Diane Kraft. And Paul and I, if you'd like to meet us in person, we will be speaking on the 31st at 10:45 a.m. And to register, you can go to the website www.phxautism.org. There is still time to register. And the other announcement I wanted to make is on Friday, April 20th, there is an autism benefit at the Compound Grill in Scottsdale. It's called Taiwan On for Autism. And it's going to be a wonderful night of food, entertainment. There's a band of people who have Asperger's. They've formed a band, and there's going to be music, and they're comedians, and a featured cocktail called The Spectrum. And so it should be a really great time. For more information on that, you can actually email me at kim@autismwithexcellence.com, and I'd be happy to email you additional details on that.
Wow, that sounds phenomenal. The Compound Grill, Scottsdale.
It's the bomb.
Oh, that is the bomb. So continuing from last week, but before I say that, I'm really looking forward to your joint workshop that you and Paul are
presentation.
Presentation.
Yeah.
At 10:45 a.m. Saturday. Mm-hmm. I love that.
The 31st, yeah.
Oh, wow. I can't wait. I'm going to be there.
Okay.
And we're going to be talking about pretty much what we've been talking about last month and we'll be talking about today on the show. Of course, live, you'll have the opportunity to ask us questions afterwards, so there's always that. And what we've been talking about is life is more than a skill set. And we've sort of talked so far about how autism looks to people, how it looks like a series of individual sort of clear-cut problems, certain behaviors, things someone does, and how it can sort of go beyond that, that there are underlying problems that are more than just the sum of the symptoms. You know, the whole is more than the sum of the parts. That's true for autism as it is for anything else. And so what we're going to talk a little bit about today is sort of what it means that autism is more than how it changes our approach to helping someone on the spectrum, knowing that autism isn't just a set of behaviors, but a set of underlying thought processes that create these behaviors.
Exactly. And in previous shows, we've talked about sort of the idea of the outside-in approach, assuming that you teach something, I'm going to say on the surface or observable, and the idea that when you do that, it transfers inward to understanding the why and things like that. And that's not often the case in autism. So today we want to sort of talk about the developmental progression and the inside-out way of teaching and guiding a person on the spectrum. And this goes for people of all ages. I want to keep clarifying that because a lot of questions I get are, you know, some of the things, are these applicable to younger kids? And that, no, that's not true. It's just human behavior, human development. There's no age cap on brain change. So in previous shows, we talked a lot about, you know, identifying observable behaviors and people having the desire to change the behavior by actually working on addressing that particular behavior, whether it's giving cues or prompts or visual cues, verbal cues, things like that. And really, we want to think about what we're thinking about in terms of how to employ skills that we learn, how to make decisions, basically, on when to use these processes, why to use these processes, and to be able to use them independently. That's a big problem that I see with addressing skills and observable behavior alone, is that a lot of times people on the spectrum will get stuck in terms of they can do the skill, but they didn't learn the mental process on how to volitionally employ it. So of their own will, use it. When and why. So those sort of things. And it can become, obviously, I would imagine, very, very frustrating and depressing, especially when it's so concrete. If you learn a skill, basic, let's say, you know, clap your hands, sit down, stand up, come here, anything like that, you either do it or you don't. And when somebody has a skill mastered, in their minds, they're doing it. They're right. What more could it be? I've done what someone's asked. How could there be more? You know, and there's a lot of context involved with our culture and how we relate to people. And, you know, you can even learn, and I think I brought this example up in the past, but in a lot of the work I've done, I've seen people of all ages learn skill responses to communication. And they don't even really know what they're responding. They just know they're supposed to. So for example, you know, you say, hi, how are you? The other person is supposed to say, I'm fine, or I'm fine, thank you, or something like that. Kids have actually been trained to respond like that, when really they're not employing their internal processes. They're not always fine. I mean, I've seen a little girl actually in tears when she, I'm fine, you know, and she was clearly wasn't fine. So, you know, she had the skill to reply just as she was taught, trained, but she wasn't really able to tap into her own thinking and her own feelings and communicating honestly. She didn't know that that was valued and that was the point.
Well, there's also the aspect of interpreting whether that's a social how are you or a genuine, you know, how are you? You know, am I supposed to tell them what's going wrong, or am I supposed to say I'm fine because I don't want to make their day worse? You know, which kind of how are you is
or
that?
Or not so even knowing that it would
that
matter.
Even knowing that there is a distinction.
Right. And I mean, I think, and this is where sort of the emotional thought processes come in, but depending on who you are and your relationship with the person with autism, if there's a strong sense of trust, a person could interpret that how are you from that partner as, wow, if I tell them I might be comforted, they may have an answer, I may feel better, you know? And a lot of times people on the spectrum haven't made that connection that could be possible. You know, if I express myself a certain way or I show a certain feeling or give a certain face or something, that there's a reciprocal sort of emotional response that could potentially alleviate feelings, heighten feelings, provide insight, things like that. And if you don't know that that's possible, why would you say anything except what you were taught?
But also, it seems to me there'd be a subcontext, too, over another subcontext, like an exception to the rule and another exception. That's the flexibility. That's what I think you're talking about, the processes, is that understanding when and where you use a certain skill. So if someone says, if you teach them not, just don't say you're fine as being polite,
right.
But like Paul was saying, is that, well, do you really say, well, I'm actually not fine, I had this happen today. But then the subcontext is knowing who you're saying that to. Maybe
right.
It's a mom or dad you might want to say it to, but a complete stranger.
Right.
So there's context
exactly.
After context.
And that's where that But that's where in development, if that reciprocal emotional feedback wasn't developed, and again, the emotional feedback has nothing to do with how much a parent would love their child or anything like that. It's when the person with autism isn't processing or understanding some of the feedback that parents are presenting, and there's a misunderstanding on the side of the parents, like they don't like me, they don't love me, they don't want to look at me, they don't want to hang out. When that's not the case, there's just a lack of understanding and communication difficulty. But a lot of times, and this is what I find very interesting and hope to make changes to in terms of the autism community, is a lot of times we teach to what these people are naturally good at, which is learning rules. And sometimes that's helpful, but if you provide a rule for things that are dynamic, people will fail. So if you teach, okay, if I teach them the script, how are you, I'm fine, they will be able to reciprocate conversation.
And an important fact is also that if you teach them the rules, you create an illusion of competence. You teach them this is what to do, and they say, okay, now I know what to do. So when they do fail, instead of it being I don't know what to do, I failed, which feels bad, it's I thought I knew what to do, I failed. Clearly I don't understand myself or what's going on. It's more of a fall. It's like tripping when you're walking versus tripping when you're running. So
that's I like how you said an illusion of competence, because that's what it is. And I think I've seen a lot of professionals. I think the shift in thinking is critical in order to help people on the spectrum move forward in their thinking and competence. Because you're right. If here I am, I'm following the rules, I did what this person said, and I'm still failing in life, or I'm still not able to. A lot of even little kids, teenagers, can't hold conversations and make friends because they're doing it by the scripts. But if you're trying to interact with people, you can't have a script. You have to be in the moment, judging, evaluating, observing, adjusting continuously. So if I were just to walk in here and no matter what's going on around me, follow a script, it would be very odd to the flow. It would be disconnected. There'd be a lot of misunderstandings. And that's what happens in the process of that kind of development. So it's not a bad thing to evaluate strengths and work on strengths or work in the venue of things that are enjoyable to these people. But you have to be careful that you're not creating that illusion of competence, and you're teaching in a dynamic way versus, you know, we call it a static way or script-based or rule-based solely. And I think there's a balance. I mean, some of the things I've done is providing a structure is good, and gradually making that structure more and more dynamic over time. Sometimes you need a structure just to get a point across, but you can't let that be the end-all be-all of everything. And so it's a different way of thinking about learning, teaching, processing, integrating, and things like that. So that's why I think Paul and I, or mostly Paul, has sort of identified this kind of thinking as more of the inside-out approach. And truly, that's what development is. It is an inside-out approach. It's not the reverse. So it looks like we're maybe going to take a break. I can tell by the nonverbal.
Yes, it was the pen pointing to the clock.
No, okay. Actually, it was your eyes looking at the clock.
I know. It was a couple hints. Context related.
Yes. Cool.
Looking at the clock. And we'll be right back with Understanding Autism, starring Paul Loudon and Kim Isaac. Paul, all the way from Houston, Texas. How's the weather there, by the way?
It was wet yesterday.
Oh, wet, and it's sunny,
very
beautiful
wet
here in Phoenix. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Lisa Masters, single mom to two amazing boys on the spectrum and author of The Funny Side of Autism. April 20th marks the first annual Time One On for Autism benefit at the Compound Grill in Phoenix. It will be a fun night out to benefit the Autism Society Greater Phoenix Chapter. We have a wonderful evening planned, including dinner, entertainment, silent auctions, raffles, and a copy of my latest book, The Funny Side of Autism Around the World. For ticket info, go to the calendar tab at thecompoundgrill.com. Hope to see you there.
In today's environment, short sales, foreclosures, and bankruptcy seem to be the norm and not the exception. These events can be devastating emotionally as well as financially. But just when you thought it was over, you might start to wonder about the tax consequences of short sales, foreclosures, and bankruptcy. Tax law can be very complex, and it would be critical to understand the tax laws surrounding your situation. Call Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor, at 602-625-3074, 602-625-3074 to discuss your situation. He looks forward to talking with you.
Ridenour, Hyten & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues in corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Ridenour, Hyten & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
Tax time is here again. Let Bierenbaum and Spiegel relieve your burden and stress while we provide you with easy and sophisticated preparation on your tax return. Whether you are a business such as a partnership or a corporation, as well as an individual, state, or trust, we can help you with your tax return preparation in a way that allows you to feel safe and secure. Bierenbaum and Spiegel has experienced, knowledgeable, and personable CPAs and staff and look forward to helping you. Please call 602-266-5633 and ask for Mitchell Spiegel, CPA.
Welcome back to Understanding Autism. We are talking about life is more than a skill set. You can call us if you want to comment at 602-296-3632 or text us at 832-278-1441. We've been talking about the idea that you can have skills and they won't necessarily help you in day-to-day life. I think Kim wants to talk about how the development, the natural development of a person leads to a different way of developing than the skills inwards approach that naturally would develop inside out, and that you know, that when looking at therapeutic approaches, it helps also to encourage this inside out development. You can't necessarily force inside out development because you can't really teach thought processes, but you can encourage the natural development of those thought processes because someone on the spectrum is sort of behind on this natural development. They aren't necessarily damaged or unable, but rather that they're just sort of delayed in some of these developments that would be typical. And so the idea is to help catch up in those areas of weakness.
Yes. And one of the ways, I mean, developmentally, is obviously you can't go into someone's mind and force a change. But the idea behind this is it really does all start with self-regulation. Physiological regulation, meaning having an affect that's optimal for learning. And a lot of times for people that have autism, their affect is very dysregulated, meaning it's hard to find an optimal affect in their bodies. It's either very low and calm and kind of floppy or very hyper and active. Whereas we can have sort of a healthy middle range. It's a lot harder for people on the spectrum to have a consistent middle range. There's a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of tiredness. There's a lot of ups and downs in terms of affect. And then secondly to that, too, it's really about relationships, because basically in order to learn how to think, you learn through your caregivers how to see the world through their eyes. So if firstly you're not affectively coordinated, it's very difficult to follow and keep up with your caregiver. If you're physiologically, meaning in your body, your heart rate, your movement, your breathing, you know, the inside of you physically is feeling, you know, anxious or too sleepy and bored and things like that, it's harder to have that range to learn from your parents or be attentive to the parents and observe. You're missing out on a lot of important relational information, and building the trust in the relationship is the foundation of learning to be competent in thinking and relationships, because basically you observe, you see, oh, my behavior affects this person in a certain way, And it's not that they actually tell you, they show you. I mean, as a baby, you know, if you're the infant smiling back at your dad, they're not necessarily going to say, when you smile, it makes me smile bigger or it makes me so happy. But they're going to show you with their face. There's a reaction that happens internally when people have that, they realize the effect of you can have an influence over someone else's feelings. So, and that really, that's one of the internal motivators for typical development is you realize, wow, I have an impact on other people, my actions, my thoughts, my choices, and how I react and what I do affects another person. And you learn to develop a habit of watching that and experimenting. So sometimes you'll do something that you're not sure if it's naughty or not, or, you know, if it's going to upset. And in those cases, you adjust yourself. You might sneak, you might hide, you might move slower because you're uncertain. And really how you learn is by how the choices you're making in conjunction to the feedback you get is how you sort of develop that to a couple of things. One is internal motivation. And secondly, how to see the world through the eyes of your caregiver. And so there's a transfer of thought processes and knowledge through that feedback system. And so it's not exactly spoken, but it's there. And that connectedness makes a big difference. That's one of the things that makes a big difference.
Is it also confusing as you're developing this that you mentioned the feedback from the caregiver, but certain behaviors might affect a mom, and her feedback might be a different feedback for her dad or some other type of family member. So what you do is getting two different types of feedback, and that makes it even more confusing.
The idea that some things are wrong to do sometimes can be very confusing.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. Because that's just another dimension of trying to learn a process that you might learn the process, but it doesn't work for everyone.
Exactly. Well, and that's part of how – that's exactly why that process is important. That's how you learn to be more observant. That's how you learn to realize, wow, this worked with mom. That didn't work with dad.
Right.
You know, mommy lets me have this and daddy won't. Oh.
Well, and the understanding of the different dimensions of the current situation, you know, that you know, maybe as a little kid, it's okay to run around naked in your room, not okay to run around naked outside. Picking up the difference between my room and outside can be difficult. And so then how do I know whether the supermarket is like my room because it's indoors or it's like outside because other people could see me? You know, like understanding what makes these situations different. Sometimes, you know, in typical development, more of that is implied. And someone on the spectrum may need some more guidance in seeing the connections between different situations.
Yeah, and again, a lot of that is learned. It's a combination. It's a combination of your mother saying, okay, let's put our clothes on, we're going out, but also watching that that's what everyone around me is doing. And if you're not observing that, you're missing that part of the context and the dynamic flow of that, and also just dressing differently for different places. You know, and this takes a long time. So this isn't just infants and then we're done. This is sort of a process that moves, I mean, into like adulthood. But you think about through observing and feedback, not just verbal, although verbal is part of it, you learn how to or when it's important to observe, why you observe, and you want to do more. I mean, internally, it's not like you're saying in your head, I want to do more of this, but you naturally learn that doing more of that provides a better result and a heightened sense of confidence.
So is that the same as saying the feedback you get can be viewed as positive reinforcement or not? Or is that sort of the issues on the spectrum is that it's hard to tell if it's positive or negative?
It's hard to tell if it's positive or negative. And with problems with episodic memory, it doesn't have the same kind of weight that it does for other people because something positive that happened to me yesterday hardly even matters anymore. You know, it doesn't stick with a person the same way. So the weight of positive reinforcement might require lots and lots of repetition compared to a normal person. And same with negative reinforcement to really create an aversion from or an attraction toward a certain type of behavior.
And also that the idea of clarifying what things mean. I mean, a lot of time, I mean, in typical development, there is a natural element of clarifying. Parents sort of innately know how to adjust themselves, you know, to their kids. So, like, if, you know, okay, so let's say your infant's starting to escalate, maybe getting fussy or about to cry. There's a natural thing inside that you go, oh, come here, and you try to de-escalate them. And nobody really tells you, okay, when the baby cries, you need to go get them. But you start to sense that because their affect's changing and things like that. But the paw that, or the paw, the paw that Point is making now, the point that Paul is making is interpreting, because a lot, the brain of a person on the spectrum gravitates more to the literal sort of structure or systematic way of feedback, taking in the facial stuff, the tone, the intention, reading that stuff isn't what really stands out first. It's like, wait, I did this last time, it was good, or I did this last time, it was bad. Why is it different now? And I think the importance of clarifying on the part of the guide is a key point. So I think we're going to take another break.
Yes.
All right.
Good observation.
All right. Who's taking us to break here?
All right. This is Understanding Autism, starring Paul Loudon, all the way from Houston, Texas, and Kim Isaac. And by the way, you can hear more of Understanding Autism tomorrow, 3 to 4.
Yes.
Same
sir.
Topic? Continuation or more?
General same ideas, yeah.
Excellent. And we'll be right back.
Tax time is here again. Let Bierenbaum and Spiing relieve your burden and stress while we provide you with easy and sophisticated preparation on your tax return. Whether you are a business such as a partnership or a corporation, as well as an individual, state, or trust, we can help you with your tax return preparation in a way that allows you to feel safe and secure. Bierenbaum and Spiing has experienced, knowledgeable, and personable CPAs and staff and look forward to helping you. Please call 602-266-5633 and ask for Mitchell Spiing, CPA.
Ridenour, Hynten & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues in corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Ridenour, Hynten & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
Your body is the greatest gift that you will ever be given. How well are you taking care of yours? Hey everyone, this is Journey Reeves, owner of Mind Body Unlimited. More important than time or money, your health is the secret to a truly wealthy life. We can customize an exercise and diet program that greatly enhances your quality of life. If you are sick and tired of feeling sick and tired, give us a buzz at 480-370-7768. That's 480-370-7768 to schedule your free, no-obligation consultation today.
Welcome back to Understanding Autism. We've been working on the topic, Life is More Than a Skill Set. We just talked a bit about the way that you approach the development of internal processes. And I wanted to talk a little bit about my personal experience briefly, that as some of you watching the show may have noticed, I am definitely very verbal.
Just fairly.
I said very verbal. I speak a lot. I talk a lot. All right. I'm hard to shut up at times. But
no comment.
And I wanted to talk about, you know, my sort of experience, because I came at this from a different direction, sort of, you know, having a lot of the day-to-day skills and becoming more and more aware of not understanding, realizing that I didn't understand, where before I just sort of didn't understand what I was supposed to do. I started to realize and think about, you know, why did this fail? What was I supposed to have done here? And sort of analyzing my own actions. And this was a little bit before I was diagnosed. And then after I was diagnosed, it was like, ah, that's why. And I sort of saw with the diagnosis that I still needed to figure it out, obviously. But now I knew why I needed to figure it out. And what one thing I noticed is that as you sort of develop the skills, as you start approaching life more analytical, you look at situations, you break them down, you consciously think, oh, her face is flushed, oh, her forehead is scrunched, oh, you know, her voice is raised, she must be angry, or, you know, you start putting things together on a conscious level. It sort of works against you in a way, because it's harder to sort of let those internal processes take over when you have this framework of very conscious things that you're doing every time you're in a social situation. It uses a lot of energy. But every time you're in a social situation, you are trying to think about all these things. And it's very hard to let go and stop thinking. And that's something that I'm not really sure how to address necessarily. But as you get more of the skill side of things, you think more on day-to-day life. You think more about things you encounter. You are consciously approaching everything where ideally, you'd like to let your subconscious and maybe your emotions take over more. And it's very hard not to have that tight grip on yourself in day-to-day life. It's a very tense feeling a lot of the time.
Hmm. Well, let me ask you this, then. In the typical learning scenario, the cycle is usually you start with a conscious incompetence to conscious competence. Mm-hmm. And you go from that to unconscious incompetence to unconscious competence.
That's exactly right.
Wow. How did I know that?
Okay. I was just wondering the same thing.
Oh, NLP. Okay, neuro-linguistic programming. Now, the thing is that also the case when you're on the spectrum, or is that that itself as a process circumvented somehow?
I think that the idea is that some of the unconscious stuff is delayed to the point where the conscious stuff can kind of overwhelm it, that you're thinking too much to allow it the room to develop. It's you can only keep – your mind can only handle so many things at once. And, you know, a lot of people on the spectrum are overwhelmed by their senses as well. They react strongly to bright lights or loud noises, or have to have loud noises, or react to certain smells or touches or things. And so there's sort of a feeling that certain parts of your brain are overwhelmed by their own thoughts or by their inputs, and that leaves the brain little time to get other things done. It's think about your computer. If you run too many programs, you can't run any more programs because it just isn't fast enough, and the whole thing sort of clogs down and stops working well. And that's sort of part of the situation you're running into, is there's too much going on in some areas, and it's hard for other areas to keep up.
So, you know, that's interesting then, because then that was one of my questions is how do you teach the process, and specifically this process is if you look at it like Paul, the analogy, having too many programs running consciously at one time, that really slows the system down. Is part of it just allowing one skill process at a time and mastering it and going to another one? But what would be the process? How do you teach something like this rather than just behaviors and skill sets? Really, like, you're really teaching flexibility in your observation.
Well, yes. Well, you are. But you're also working on some other things, because I just want to bring up, and I'm going to answer your question, but as Paul said, well, first of all, a person on the spectrum doesn't have, like, broken neural pathways or anything like that. They're maybe weaker. If you think of it like a muscle, it's a little more, I guess you could say, flabby than a typical person. You have to strengthen it up. So instead of having, you know, like the jiggle arm, I hope not. Yeah, I saw that.
BreakRadioShow.com. You can view the jiggle arm right now.
Thanks.
Break Radio Show.
Thank you for not arguing.
No,
So just like neural pathways, though, they need to be strengthened. And I think what's important and what I've learned, I mean, if you have a flabbier pathway, and you try to give them a 50-pound weight, or just if you were going to lift weights and you're a beginner or you're weak, you would fail, because your stamina, your muscle stamina is not strong enough. And it's the same with pathways. And so what I do, what RDI promotes to do, and and just developmental approaches and things like that is, I mean, firstly, you really need to have a very thorough assessment conducted. And one of the reasons for that is you really need to be able to identify what obstacles are that are taking some of your attentional resources away. So as Paul said, are you very sensitive to, you know, sounds, lights, touches, and things like that? Is that obstacle partially contributing to where your attentional resources are going? So it's important to do actually like an obstacle assessment. And then it's important to do just like a developmental from the social emotional standpoint assessment to see where a person is, because there's a lot of sort of gaps in that part of the development for a person that has autism. So they may have some of the pieces and some things got skipped over, and then they have others. If you try to teach from the top where you see they're going versus address some of the holes, there's always going to be that gap and that problem. So the key to helping to support someone or teach or guide a person to develop, it requires the best understanding you can of the entire person, where they're at, what their obstacles are, so forth. The second piece is breaking things down in very, very small parts. And in order to do that, oftentimes requires a very strong relationship of trust and communication, because no expert or trained professional knows, I mean, nobody really knows another person. I mean, what someone's feeling and thinking through observing, you can sort of tell, and also through really good communication. So you, as a therapist, you want to try to do the best you can to really observe the person and develop a relationship with them so they can partner up with you in terms of working together to develop this. Another piece is slowing down. You really have to meet the person at the pace that they feel confident and that they can handle, and slowly add pieces. So I do have an example of this, actually. I think I've said it before, but it's very relevant to what we're talking about. I worked with a young teenager who was afraid to play ball, and there was nothing more. His father really wanted to learn to play catch with his son, and it was just something the dad was like, I don't care if he learns anything else. I just want to play ball with my son. And the sight of bringing out the balls, the son would run away. And instantly he had this like visual cue of, I can't do this. I'm going to get hurt. I'm going to drop it. I mean, it was a very instantaneous reaction. And so what I decided to do in my mind, and we call it scaffolding, is how can I break this down to where every step of the way this boy feels safe and competent, and then add just a little bit of uncertainty to kind of push his threshold at a pace that's very systematic and safe. So basically, I said, hey, let's come sit down together. And I had a whole basket of different kinds of balls, but I just took out one. And he started to have a reaction. I said, we're just going to look at it. We're not going to do anything with it. I just want to look at it. This is cool. It has Spider-Man on it. You know, we looked at a few different ones. And he wouldn't touch it or anything. So first, we were just looking. Second, it was like, well, let's see what it feels like. This one was smooth. The other one was rough. And he goes, yeah. And I said, okay, so we've seen them. We felt them. I wonder what else we could do to kind of promote that dynamic. Because all he had known was catch and throw, catch and throw. Oh, my gosh, it's too overwhelming. So all of his resources were in the fear and the motor incompetence. So then finally it was like, okay, so why don't we roll it very slowly? So I literally, with my hand, pretty much pushed it across. I didn't even let go of it. And we did that several times. And then I said, okay, I'm going to do a little bit faster. So then I pushed, and I was able to let go. Then we're rolling it back and forth fast, and it's okay. And then I said, how about we stand up and do it? I'll hand it to you. You can hand it to me. So we literally just exchanged it. And within 30 minutes, this boy is playing catch.
I like it. That's such a great approach. It's similar to Paul's analysis, crawl, walk, run, because it's sort of a sequential progression of learning. Also, maybe you can equate it to swimming, where, you know, do you want to just throw someone in the pool, or do you just put one of your toes in first, and maybe your foot, right? Slow, slow, slow. I like that approach.
Well, and I have another quick example I'll just give of this, too. And it looks like we have a question, a text question.
Which we'll probably get to right after the break.
After the break, yeah. Another example of this is an adult that I work with who doesn't have a lot of observable physical skills. This is someone actually you guys have heard a lot about. He's famous in my life, Kyle. And some of my listeners who are people I know will know exactly who I'm talking about. But anyway, he's very impaired in terms of motor skills and cognitive skills and things like that. And we really needed him to start getting more exercise. And we knew he could walk, but being outside was a little too overwhelming for him. He needed a little more structure. So we decided, let's try the treadmill. Well, just looking at the treadmill, he was very afraid. It was this machine. It was big. It made noise. And so for months and months and months, all Kyle and I did, we set up chairs and we just sat near the treadmill and looked at it. I mean, really months of just looking. Then it was just touching. Then I would turn it on and let him watch it. Then it was, I mean, this like took a year and he did it. And now he can run on the treadmill.
Really? He can run?
Yeah.
That is fabulous.
Yeah, he can. And, you know, a lot of people were giving me sort of the, not the stink eye, what's the weird eye? Like the...
the crazy eye?
The crazy eye. Like, let's see if this is
going
to work.
And I think that illustrates something important, though, is don't expect it to take 30 minutes every time. That it can be a very slow process, and that the important thing is to remember that it is a process, that you're taking steps. And you need to progress at the level they're comfortable with. And as they gain more competence in other areas, they may be more comfortable progressing more quickly in some things, but it can start off very slow.
And that's exactly this last point I want to say before the break is that it's all about the process. I never put a time expectation on anything because that will really take my attentional resources out of the moment. And being in the moment is how you be a good guide because you need to coordinate and observe with your student. And if you're thinking about time frames and rushing, your attentional resources aren't fully where they need to be. So on that note, I think we're going to take a quick break and we're going to come back and answer. We have a text question. I love questions that we're going to answer. And we're going to continue our discussion about life is more than a skill set. And we will be right back with more Understanding Autism.
In today's environment, short sales, foreclosures, and bankruptcy seem to be the norm and not the exception. These events can be devastating emotionally as well as financially. But just when you thought it was over, you might start to wonder about the tax consequences of short sales, foreclosures, and bankruptcy. Tax law can be very complex, and it would be critical to understand the tax laws surrounding your situation. Call Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor at 602-625-3074, 602-625-3074 to discuss your situation. He looks forward to talking with you.
Hey, I'm Lisa Masters, single mom to two amazing boys on the spectrum and author of The Funny Side of Autism. April 20th marks the first annual Time Went On for Autism benefit at the Compound Grill in Phoenix. It will be a fun night out to benefit the Autism Society Greater Phoenix Chapter. We have a wonderful evening planned, including dinner, entertainment, silent auctions, raffles, and a copy of my latest book, The Funny Side of Autism Around the World. For ticket info, go to the calendar tab at thecompoundgrill.com. Hope to see you there.
Are you standing at a crossroad in life wondering what's next? Is it time to reinvent your relationship, your career, your life? Whether you're ready for a reinvention revolution or a reinvention evolution, the support of a couple of great coaches can get you there. When you decide it's time to take your life from just functional to optimal, call Joe and Lori Battaglia of Living the Dream Coaches, 888-505-5762. That's 888-505-5762 or go online to www.livingthedreamcoaches.com. That's www.livingthedreamcoaches.com.
Welcome back to Understanding Autism. We've been talking about life is more than a skill set. And during the last segment, we had a listener question. I had talked a little bit about how positive and negative reinforcement are strongly tied to episodic memory and how they may not have as much weight. And a questioner asked, does a child with autism need to be punished multiple times for a single bad event? And I would definitely say no. I think the point I was going for there is more that the weight of the punishment may not stick with them as well as it might with a neurotypical child, that don't expect it to really stick the first time. I wouldn't say punish them more than once, but be aware that the event may repeat, and it may take a few instances of punishment with repeated events before it really sticks. I think that if you punish them more than once, there's a really high risk of them misunderstanding why they're being punished and how the punishment correlates to the event. So it's more of a case of trying to understand what the child's thought process is when they do the event, and maybe not necessarily even thinking about punishment, but thinking about increasing the understanding of why this event was bad. Punishment is sort of a way that we as people create a negative reinforcement for something that may not immediately have negative connotations to the person doing it. If I do something as a young child, I go running outside naked. I don't understand why that's bad. As an adult, I understand why it's considered a bad thing. But as a child, I don't understand why it's bad. So because I don't necessarily have the framework in place to understand why it's bad, you punish me for it so that I immediately go, I don't want to be punished. So doing it is bad because I get punished. When the punishment doesn't carry the same weight, you don't have that thought process of, I remember how bad punishment was last time. That connection doesn't build as quickly. Punishing more than once doesn't really help that build because it's not really connected as strongly to the event anymore. It's just sort of now my parents think I'm a bad kid, so I'm getting punished all the time. It doesn't have the same connections. So I think the idea is just that be aware it may take longer to teach the same lessons when the reinforcements that you have aren't equated as easily. And maybe if you can come up with a way to explain why it's bad that they can relate to, that might help.
And I was thinking the exact same thing. You absolutely, absolutely do not want to overcorrect or overpunish. That's very damaging. Again, holding whatever happened in the mind of a child with autism may not be sticking. So 1 minute they did something, it may be completely out of their mind by the time you go and punish them. It's going to be very confusing, very upsetting, and lead to more withdrawal. Now, I don't even like the word punishment, actually. What I like to think of is you want to treat your kids with autism the way you would typical kids. Now, the difference is, in terms of how you teach them to understand, is what we talked about before the break, is you slow down. You make sure that you're, the difference between, disciplining a typical child and an autistic child, the only difference is you may be slowing down and explaining more and having more patience within the discipline. You really don't need to talk to them any different or behave any different, aside from really making sure that you're clearly identifying the why. And also realizing that, guidance is more important than punishing. Innately, at least what I've noticed, every single person with autism that I've ever known does not have that, I guess you could say, malicious intent that a child may have at times. I mean, all children are good and all that stuff, but it's very, very, I've just never seen compared to typical kids.
Maybe you're thinking of the mischievous side?
The mischievous side is there's no intention to be naughty with people with autism. I have never seen that for the most part. I mean, I'm not saying they're not human, but what that's often misinterpreted as naughty behavior, where a lot of typical kids, they understand and they're making a choice on purpose, because they understand. A person with autism doesn't understand and they're making a choice and they're being punished as if they did understand. So it's very important that the priority is clarifying and making sure that you're actually teaching something and not just reacting to whatever you saw.
Now, let me ask you this, both Paul and Kim, in context of that question, is the reaction to an event that, let's say, someone on the spectrum, behavior event, could that also be, that leads to punishment, for example? So the reaction to an event that could, a parent can conclude or a caregiver can conclude that this kid needs punishment, isn't that two-sided? What if the parent themselves are overly frustrated and aren't clearly seeing the event, could that be just sort of a release of anxiety on the kid?
That can happen. I mean, it's very important that parents slow down for their own sake,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, yeah.
And I was going to say that as someone on the spectrum, if you've ever read Calvin and Hobbes, there's a game Calvin likes to play called Calvin Ball. And it's a game where he gets to make up the rules, and he always wins because he gets to change them whenever he wants. And so there's a ball involved, and that's about the only thing you get to know. And life can often feel like you're playing a game of Calvin Ball where someone else is Calvin because you're getting punished for something and you don't understand why you're getting punished for it, or something good or bad happens and you don't know the rules and maybe they seem to be changing around you and you don't have the you don't have someone who can even explain them to you. When you ask, they say, well, that's the rule right now, and they can't tell you when it's going to be different or otherwise. So in a game of Calvin Ball, if you're losing points or the other side is gaining points, how would you feel if you can't do anything to gain points and you don't understand why you're losing points? That's sort of what happens when you're punishing someone on the spectrum and they don't have a full grasp of the situation. They thought that they were doing good and found out they were doing bad, and they may not have the tools to explain to you their thought process. So it's always really, really important to take that step back, look at the situation, try to figure out what really just happened here before you start thinking about punishment or explanation, or on the other side, it's also important to step back and think about rewards. What are you rewarding if you give them a reward? Are you rewarding what you think you're rewarding, or are you rewarding what they saw in that situation? So
right.
It's always important to step back and spend a little time cooling down and thinking what just happened here.
Right. And I think a lot of parents, first of all, it's totally understandable parents would be frustrated. I mean, there's just, it's frustrating because you don't understand. People are afraid and frustrated and angry about things they don't understand. It's scary. It provokes a lot of anxiety. That's all very, very normal. And so it's not bad to feel that way. It's very important to give yourself the permission to step back. A lot of times parents think, I need to get this. I am the parent. I need to correct this immediately. Obviously, if it's a safety issue, your kid's running in the street, you go grab them. Juggling knives, you grab them. But unless it's non-safety related things, it's actually better to step back and evaluate some things before approaching and teaching and guiding, which is a very important piece to being a guide to a person on the spectrum.
And I find I personally prefer fuller explanations, authority from knowledge sake, saying, look, I've done that, or I know someone who did that, and it doesn't turn out well, rather than authority for authority's sake. I'm the parent, do what I say.
Mm.
That it's very hard to relate to for me, that I should listen to someone just because they say I should listen to them.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, ultimately, and I think parents feel like, well, they, you know, I am the parent, they should listen, but
and we should give credit to whoever texts that question for
wanting
to do what Paul just said
is,
you know, get some additional information to evaluate.
Absolutely. No, yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think this is not to give parents the impression that they're not to be respected as authorities, but they really need to think about the kind of example they're setting in terms of, you know, learning to learn about why these things are and why respect is important in this and that versus just laying down the law and being forceful. So, okay, we're coming up to the end of the show.
Wow, already? This was the fastest hour in
history.
Yeah, exactly.
But it was the bomb.
Yeah, the bomb.
The bomb hour.
And we'll be coming back to this topic tomorrow, more or less a full summary from start to finish of what we've discussed over the last three shows, just for refresher and for anyone who wants to just listen to it all together. We'd love to hear your feedback on this topic at facebook.com/understandingautismradio. You can also find our podcast on iTunes. We'd love to hear from you there or tomorrow.
And this concludes it. Until tomorrow, 3 to 4, tomorrow, Tuesday, more Understanding Autism. We'll see everyone tomorrow. Have a great night. And guess what? Go Coyotes tonight, jobbing.com arena against the Nashville Predators. See you tomorrow.